Have you ever taken a stand on something? A real stand. Let's say on domestic issues like civil rights, drugs, or bullying.
Or how about a social issue like healthcare and education? What? You're too young?
In the next edition of Meet the Author, we'll meet a very courageous person. A graduate of Fairfax County Public Schools who, at a very young age, stood for freedom.
The following program is a production of the Fairfax Network, Fairfax County Public Schools.
Welcome to Meet the Author. I'm your host, Emily Godfrey. Today's guest, Loki Mulholland, is joining us via Skype. Loki is the author of the nonfiction book, She Stood for Freedom, the untold story of a civil rights hero, Joan Trumpower Mulholland. And joining us in the studio is the subject of Loki's book, civil rights activist and Loki's mom, Joan. Joan, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And Loki, thank you for joining us via Skype.
Thank you, glad I can.
Loki is not only an author, but a filmmaker as well. To set the stage for today's discussion, we're going to see a clip from Loki's documentary about Joan's significant role in the civil rights movement. The film is called An Ordinary Hero. Let's take a look.
She is, in my mind, one of those heroes that demands respect and acknowledgement. Clearly, she was a lady ahead of her time.
She walked through that mob in the war store. And they realized, of course, immediately where she stood.
She joins Perlina and Annie at the counter, the first white to join the demonstration. And at this, the crowd is just incensed. They become like hornets. They start screaming at her.
She wasn't the outside agitator. She was a white Southerner. She was a white Southern woman. And so for that purpose, she was even more dangerous to the white supremacist power structure. Here's this white Southern woman who's supposed to be protected by the system saying, I don't need this protection, and I don't believe in the system. And so that made her incredibly dangerous.
Wow, Joan, as a young person, you really were an instrument for change. I'd like to talk more about some of those iconic photos we just saw. Can you tell me what it was like to meet with Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.?
Well, it was a polite conversation. I was one of the two people that was showing him around campus to get from point A to point B and, you know, to lunch. But we still had to be in classes, so the two of us spotted each other. He was a gentleman, but, you know, nothing in depth.
And tell me about participating in sit-ins.
When you went to a sit-in, as we said, you had to have your nonviolence on. You went in and took a seat. Now, perhaps the whites went first, got some food, and then when the blacks sat down, you might share. Of course, you always bought something first to show that you were welcome in the place. And you just sat there, everyone together, until the blacks were served. And
can you tell us a little bit about the photo we're seeing here?
Well, now the photo here is the Woolworth lunch counter in Jackson, Mississippi in 1963. Most of the sit-ins were in 1960. But we just took the seat and we sat, and there was such a mob behind us of high school students. It was exam week. We hadn't calculated on that.
Oh,
one.
No.
Bad planning.
Yeah.
Now I know. And it was safer to stay at the counter with your friends on either side of you and the press on the far side of the counter. That was the best place to be, and we were just waiting to be served. And
it looked terrifying.
3 hours.
3 hours? Do you remember how you felt at that time? Do you remember having doubts in yourself?
Oh, no doubts. I mean, it was a little late for that, but it became sort of an out-of-body experience, like your soul, the real essence of you, had left the body. And you can say you can kill the body, but not the soul. And so your soul was sort of like up above, like a guardian angel. Mm-hmm. And we just tried to stay calm and crack jokes a bit and prayed a bit.
I can't imagine cracking jokes at a time
like
that.
Well, we had our professor with us, and what did we think of that example? Well, Professor Salter, you hadn't really covered that in class. And they just mentioned it a little in the book. That wasn't fair.
That's not fair.
No.
I hear students complain about that still to this day.
It's
common complaints.
But it was more like a joke than anything else.
Yeah. Well, I have a question for your son, Loki. Loki, as a writer and a filmmaker, was it intimidating to tell your mom's story? After all, she is your mom. There's no pressure, right?
Well, in all honesty, it wasn't intimidating because we really didn't know her story. She really didn't talk about that too much. It wasn't until really Stanley Nelson's Freedom Rider documentary came out and the mugshot that's now famous, where things really started to heat up. And what I learned is that if you don't ask my mom, she's not going to tell you. And so the things that we learned as we started interviewing other people, that's where the real story came out, and it just became this really kind of overwhelming to think that, you know, she had done so much of what she had done. It's just a remarkable story.
Definitely.
But now, the kids did hear the stories. Friends would come to visit with their kids, you know, Christmas holidays or something, and the parents were just with these old war stories, and the kids were just waiting to escape and go play. So he heard them, but he didn't internalize them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, was there a specific part of the story that you really wanted to get across to the reader? Or anything really important message?
Well, really the key message, which is you don't have to be a Dr. King, you don't have to be a Rosa Parks to make a difference. Anyone can make a difference. And being different is good. We need people to be different. Mm-hmm. We need those people because those are the ones that change the world.
Yeah, that's a very strong message for kids to hear. Well, we have a lot to cover in today's show, so we're going to get started with some questions from students at Stone Middle School. They read your book, and here's what they want to know.
I'm from Annandale, so I was excited to hear that you went to Annandale High School. So my question is, was Annandale High School segregated when you went?
Can you explain more about how your family and friends felt about you joining the civil rights movement?
Did you feel like you had to choose between your parents because one was a northerner and the other was a southerner?
Well, yeah, those were some great questions. Let's start with that last one. Did you feel torn between your parents?
No, back then, the women ruled the roost. And I knew that my father and mother disagreed on this, but it was my mother's, kept the voice going at home. And my father was afraid I'd get killed. So he really didn't like me doing what I was doing, though he supported the goals.
Can you tell us a little bit more about maybe how your friends felt about you joining the civil rights movement?
Well, I joined the civil rights movement when I was at Duke University, and actually my roommate, who was from New York, joined at the same time on the picket lines and ultimately the sit-ins.
And was Annandale High School segregated when you were there?
Oh, Annandale was completely segregated. Now, there were a couple of students whose mothers were Japanese and whose fathers were U.S. servicemen who had met their wives when they were stationed in Japan, but completely segregated on the black-white issue.
And Loki, I have another question for you. Yes. No doubt your upbringing was different than your mom's, and you touched on this a little bit before, but Could you tell us a little bit more about when you first grasped your mom's role in the civil rights movement?
Well, you know, we always had those photographs around the house. You know, the Jackson sit-in was the one that always stood out to me. But it wasn't really until high school when we cracked open the history book that it all started making sense. And it was like, what is mom doing in a history book?
Yeah, that would be very shocking. we will come back to you in a moment, Loki, for some more information. But we'd like to invite other people to participate in the show. So if you have a question for Loki or Joan Mulholland, please join the conversation. Call or tweet your questions to us. Right now, we're going back to Stone Middle School for some more questions. And when we return, more answers.
How long did you spend in jail, and how did you pass the time in jail?
How long were you on the Ku Klux Klan's most wanted list?
What did white people think of Joan when she was near blacks?
Can you explain why Christians thought that it was unchristian-like to believe in desegregation?
Those are some very thoughtful and complex questions. So how long were you in jail?
Well, I was arrested several times, but the Freedom Ride was the main one, and I was in jail, good 2.5 months, if not longer, from June 8th, I guess, until early September.
So we see your mugshot here. Can you tell us what you were thinking? How did you feel when this happened?
I think I was much calmer than most of the Freedom Riders because I was within my own culture. I was a white Southerner. I knew where these people were coming from, the factors that had created their attitudes. So I wasn't afraid of anything. Plus, when I stepped out of the paddy wagon, the white police officer, there were only white police officers, reached out to take my arm and help me down. We don't want anything to happen to you, chillin'. And this would not have happened if I were black, but as a white on white, he did it, and then it was like he suddenly realized I was that terrible outside agitator, and he jerked himself back. But the fact that his first instincts were good gave me faith things were going to work out.
And what was it like to be in prison? Like, what did you do during the day? What activities did you have?
Well, for the activities, we set up a routine that we had exercises, joint like you were in gym class. We had ballet lessons. We had Swahili lessons, French lessons, lots of things like that. And when we got up at Parchman Penitentiary, we set up a mock radio show where one cell had the news broadcast, one cell had a joke, one cell sang a song. Each one had the advertisement. Each cell had, on the cell block, had a different part in our mock radio show. It was fun.
It sounds like it was actually kind of fun. Did you get to hear news about the outside world? Were you kind of cut off? Were you able to communicate?
Well, I spent most of the time at Parchman, and our news came once a week when the rabbi came to visit, and anybody who wanted to pray with the rabbi, call out your cell number, and we'd go up, and he would say, oh, by the way, the ball score was, and the wardens would say, you can't tell them about that. Well, can I tell them about what's happening in Berlin? No. So they'd go on with that. And other times he'd start praying in Hebrew and sort of wait till it looked like the jailers had tuned out, and then he'd sneak in headlines. So that was our main source of news. And of course, new Freedom Riders were coming in, and they had a little bit of world news to share with us and how things were going. But we were cut off from newspapers and virtually all outside contact.
We have a graphic, it's from the book, of a letter that was written to your mother, I believe, from the warden of the jail. Could you tell us about that?
My mother had wanted to make sure, written him to make sure I had some medication for a rash I had. And he wrote back that I had everything I needed was provided. And he didn't understand why she was letting this minor white girl go roaming the countryside with these hoodlums and, I forget what word he used, colored bucks or something like that. He didn't use the N-word, but he was as close as he could get to it, you know, and just roaming around, breaking the laws and disturbing things.
What, did your mother ever reply to that?
My mother replied that basically if she could stop me from doing what I was doing, she certainly would, but I was 18 and wasn't anything she could do about it, but she certainly didn't approve.
So we'll move on to the next question the student at Stone had, which is, how long were you on the KKK's most wanted list?
I didn't even know about the KKK's most wanted list until decades later, though I understand these posters were distributed in the black community. And I was shocked and that they would X out the face of anybody who was killed. Now my friend and the NAACP leader, Medgar Evers, his face did get X'd out. And he's buried out at Arlington Cemetery.
And what did white people think of you when you were around blacks?
Oh, they thought I was a traitor and didn't go with blacks in the white community because that would endanger both of us, particularly the blacks. But it was definitely frowned on. Now, there were some whites at the lunch counter who would come over and express support. Mm-hmm. But generally it was just, we just went against everything they had grown up believing in. And we were traitors.
Yeah, that must have been very hard. Did you lose a lot of friends?
I don't think I really lost friends that, at that point, Northern Virginia was so transient that once you went off to college, you pretty much lost touch with the folks you had known before, and the college became your friend, so it wasn't a problem that way.
And the final question from Stone, why do you think Christians thought desegregation was unchristian-like?
Well, even the church supported segregation, saying that different sorts of animals don't mix, blackbirds and redbirds don't mix. And there was also the belief that black folks did not have souls that could, you know, be saved within the church, that they were a completely different species, I guess would be the word. Like cows don't have souls and horses don't, and black folks didn't. So they were not human in the same sense.
Hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about those secret meetings that you attended when you were in high school at your church that were held?
I was in Arlington. This was Arlington. And we were told one Sunday evening, we had Sunday evening spaghetti dinners and then a discussion time about Christianity and everyday life. And we were told that next week some colored, that was a polite term, colored students would be joining us. But to keep it quiet, don't tell anybody, not even your parents, because the police could come and arrest us. We'd be breaking the public assembly law in Virginia. The Nazi Party was around the corner, their headquarters, and they might show up and cause problems, or we might even get locked out of the church by some of the church elders. So we met actually for 2 weeks over spaghetti, and I stayed in touch with a couple of the girls for several years. I tried to find out where the initiative came from this, with even at 50th anniversary celebrations of school desegregation in Arlington. Did our minister contact the black community? Did the black community contact the churches? Was it happening all over the county or just us? And I could not get an answer. No one seemed to know, or they weren't telling.
Probably, or they weren't telling. I like that. As we're learning, heroes don't always wear capes, and they can be inspired to do courageous things at a very young age. Don't go away. In just a moment, our MTA student reporters have the scoop on a special visit to Annandale High School by an extraordinary person. They say she stood for freedom when it mattered most.
In 1954, the Supreme Court's ruling in Brown versus the Board of Education deemed public school segregation unconstitutional. This landmark decision is considered to be the catalyst for the modern-day civil rights movement.
However, despite this ruling, many states were very slow to comply, even right here in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Schools did not integrate right away. As a matter of fact, there was much resistance to this idea.
A group of laws known as massive resistance were passed in Virginia. When these laws were challenged, many schools closed their doors rather than integrate.
During this time period, Joan Trumpower Mulholland was attending Annandale High School. On a recent visit to AHS, Joan recollects what student life was like in 1959.
We were very race conscious. We were lily white. Black schools were known to not get the sort of funding and everything that the white schools did. So that we needed equal opportunity. I think seeing the black school when I visited my grandmother in rural Georgia and it being a shack as opposed to this brand new post-World War II brick school and just the complete inequity, I think that influenced me.
Was there anything at Annandale that shaped your motivation for your participation in the civil rights movement later on in your life?
Or maybe my sense of rebellion against all those school rules had, you know, some sort of influence on what came later. That concern and thinking about what integration was shaped things.
Equality in education was just one part of the civil rights movement. People like Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King Jr., and other brave individuals fought for equality in daily life.
Using the practices of nonviolent protest, lunch counter sit-ins, marches, and freedom rides were some ways young people brought attention to inequality.
But this was dangerous work. People were taunted, beaten, thrown in jail, and even killed.
When I got to Tougaloo College, a reporter, Larry Still, with I think Jet Magazine and Afro and all, asked my name, and I didn't want to endanger anybody back in Virginia. So I just, Trumpower, how do you spell that? Made it up. That was good. It protected people who weren't involved.
Without the courage of civil rights activists like Ms. Mulholland, maybe schools like ours would be very different places of learning today.
One of the things that we pride ourselves about our school is the amount of diversity. And you can see that 78% of Annandale students speak a language at home, which is different than what you experienced back then.
It's a different world. Right over there is a girl with purple hair. Man, she would have been expelled back in the day. Of course, she might not have been admitted to the school in the first place. I don't think I see anybody on down this line that would have been in this school. Yeah, it's really nice to see this embodiment of how far we've come, to see essentially the United Nations here. And nobody seems to have an edge about sitting next to anybody or just all mixed wherever they happen to land. And in the halls, I see students from all backgrounds walking together, talking together. I like that.
Go Adams, Joan Nelson Mulholland, class of 59. It's been a while. Thank you.
Thank you.
That must have been a powerful experience visiting high school again.
Oh, it takes you back and wow.
Loki, I have a question for you. Could you tell us a little bit about your foundation?
Sure. I named it the Joan Trumpower Mulholland Foundation, which my mom feels is a little excessive in naming it after her, but I thought that was appropriate. As you can already tell, she's very low-key in that regards. It was created to not only preserve and share my mother's story, but to share the civil rights movement with students and to really just kind of empower them, that teach them some principles about how they too can make a difference, how they can change their world.
And I know that you wrote two versions of the book for two different age levels. Can you tell us a little bit about the illustrations? They're so cool, and they have this amazing folk art feel to them.
Sure. Yeah, the art style is called retro collage. Charlotta Jansen, during the 2011, which was the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Ride, she came down with some portraits that she had done of the Freedom Riders, and it really struck me, just stuck with me. And so I told my mother that, you know, I was going to do this book. She says, well, don't make the images look like Disney. That was her one requisite. And so I said, well, I've got Charlotta who wants to do them. She's perfect. Do them. And so it was really about just, you know, using that primary source content so that people can see that these were real things, but create it in a style that would be engaging and fit the tone. I mean, it's a much more serious tone in these books. But that was the idea behind the imagery. One was to please my mother, and two was to make it engaging and visually, that's what I'm looking for.
Pleasing. They're very beautiful and very captivating. Can you tell us a little bit more about your writing process?
When my mother had, it started a couple of years ago when she was, we were doing an assembly, and she was reading a book to a bunch of kids here in Utah, and I was like, why is she reading someone else's book? She needs to read her own story.
Yeah.
And at that same time, an old classmate of mine, Angela Farewell from fourth grade, and African-American female, we were in contact with each other on Facebook, and she's like, have you ever thought about writing a book about your mom? I said, matter of fact, I have. Do you want to help? We basically modeled it after the story in the documentary, and just which was the motivation anyways. We knew not every kid was going to watch the documentary, and some of the content there was going to be a little too intense for them. So we wanted to be able to get it down to that level for younger and younger age groups.
So you did the film first, and then you wrote the book?
Correct.
I'm sorry. Keep going.
And when the books came out, the idea came, let's get it even further. And so we created a curriculum package. We partnered with an education-based company here in Utah called Studies Weekly, and they helped us put together a package that we can get it straight down to the kids so they have something that they can have on their own beyond just the books.
And how did you conduct your research, since you did use so many primary sources and interviews?
That was easy. My mom is an archivist in the Civil Rights Movement. They teased her back in the day, and now they think it's amazing that she has all this, to the point that even the Smithsonian still tries to get their hands on it. She keeps sharing it. But we had all that. So I scanned it all. Mike O'Brien, who wrote the book, We Shall Not Be Moved, had done a lot of research over, 10, 15 years. So he had already started capturing all those stories, and it was during the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Rides, when we were down in Mississippi, that I was able to start, gathering people who knew her and get these interviews together. And that's how it all kind of came together. And based off of that research, all of that flowed to the film, which then flowed into the book.
That's such important work. Loki, we are almost out of time, but before we go, briefly, what advice can you give to young writers?
Write what you're passionate about. And you don't have to do it all in one day. Take your time, but research, research, and research. Even if it's fiction, research. It adds much greater validity to what you're talking about. And don't be afraid for the feedback. Criticism is good when it's from people who actually know what they're talking about. But the goal is to get something that you feel great about and that other people want to engage with.
As a librarian, I appreciate the research plug.
Yeah, I want to say that though my son says an ordinary hero, ordinary is the key word, but I was just one of thousands and thousands and thousands of students who were sitting in, marching, going to jail. I just happened to end up with a son who is a filmmaker and a publisher. So,
well, it was a pleasure to have both of you here today. I wish that we had more time to continue this conversation. Loki, thank you so much for joining us. Joan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Definitely. If you would like to learn more about Joan and Loki, visit their foundation website. To learn more about our upcoming programs, visit the Fairfax Network. For the Fairfax Network, I'm Emily Godfrey. Keep reading, keep writing, and keep dreaming. Thanks for watching.